Hello, everybody. This is New Books in Psychology, and I'm your host, Eugenio Duarte, in New York. On today's show, we're discussing psychotherapy. What exactly is it, and how is it different from other ways of dealing with mental and emotional suffering? To tackle these questions, we're speaking to Joe Frasca, author of the book Delving Deeper, Understanding Diverse Approaches While Exploring Psychotherapy, published in 2016 by Joe Frasca Publishing. Joe Frasca is a psychotherapist in private practice in Sydney, Australia, combining transactional analysis and the relational model in her work, informed by psychoanalytic theory and thinking. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Hayu.
So before we get into the book, tell me about yourself. What's your professional background and where do you live and practice?
I live in Sydney in New South Wales, Australia, and I practice in Sydney as well. I have two practices. I have a home practice actually, and I have a practice in the CBD in Sydney to keep me honest and get me out of bed in the mornings. I work longer term with people, obviously, which will be reflected in the book, and I spend time writing, and I have begun blogging as well.
So because we're going to be talking about psychotherapy and all the different kinds of psychotherapies as well as non-psychotherapies that are available, what kind of psychotherapy do you offer and how is it different from other approaches that are out there?
For me, that's a big question. That's the premise of the book in many ways. For me, psychotherapy is psychotherapy, and that psychotherapy is a particular way of working which was developed obviously by Freud and his crew, and that it is psychotherapy describes longer-term work with people where you work with the transference and the counter-transference as opposed to working shorter or using interventions.
So what would you call the latter?
The latter?
Meaning these shorter-term interventions, would you not call them psychotherapy?
No. That's a very good question. No, I wouldn't call them psychotherapy. I would perhaps call them, counselling or psychology intervention with CBT. CBT is probably the most common and well-known approach that people use that is out there on the airways for clients. If someone is looking for treatment, they are usually going to get CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy of some description, and I wouldn't class that as psychotherapy. I know education, and I mentioned this in my book as well. I know education in the United States is a little different, that they teach psychotherapy as an intervention. In Europe, it's quite different. Psychotherapy is longer term. It's very specifically a standalone modality where people go for longer term treatment when other approaches haven't worked.
So, we've already walked right into one of the things that interested me most about your book and this topic, because here in the United States where I practice, things are very different. I think a lot of people would consider CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, which is one of the many short-term focused approaches that you mentioned before, would consider that to be not only a form of psychotherapy, but depending on who you ask, maybe from the insurance company's point of view, the predominant and most empirically supported form of psychotherapy available to people. And so I'm wondering how you feel about that and how that differs from the kind of training that you received in Australia.
Yes, that's a very complex question, which I think I'm in the process of still pulling apart, even after spending several years writing a book and and the research that I did. So I think that something has happened at some point in time where the word psychotherapy has begun to be used in a different context to which it was developed in the early days through the work of Freud and Jung. So psychotherapy was a description for, as I said earlier, longer term work where you're looking at very particular things. You're working with an archaic part of the person's history, so very much around early family of origin work. You're working with the transference and the counter transference, as opposed to, for example, what insurance companies want you to do. They actually don't want you to do the longer term work. They don't want you to be looking at the archaic work. They really want you to be developing a strategy with the client to help them put things in place that will fix whatever the problem is, and that's usually much shorter term work. So I think what's happened over a long period of time, there's been an erosion of the meaning of what psychotherapy is. And what my attempt to do in this book is to bring back what the original meaning of psychotherapy was. And I'm talking quite a long, long time ago now. And I think if you had this conversation in Europe, it would be quite different. In Europe, there is a delineation around the difference between psychotherapy being longer-term work and what shorter-term work is.
So just to be clear, were you trained in Australia?
Yes, I was. I was trained in Australia by a European group.
And what did your training consist of?
Okay, so the training is a psychotherapy training. As I said, my training is in transactional analysis, and the transactional analysis training is an international training. So it's the same in America as it is in Europe, as it is in South America, as it is in New Zealand. There's a standard training program. It's 4 years. The requirement is that you have a prior degree in a related area. My prior degree in the related area is in social science. And so you do 4 years training around specific psychotherapy theory. And then you go into an exam process. So, you know, basically it's a master's of psychotherapy. And that's the way they train for psychotherapy in Europe as well. And I know it's quite different in America.
So let's get into the book, because one of the things that I recall from the book, and tell me if I'm getting this wrong, is that you talk about receiving training in CBT before later on receiving training in psychotherapy. Is that correct?
Well, yes. In a prior degree, usually most of the university degrees in Australia are CBT bent mostly. So most people don't jump straight into a psychotherapy training. They have to have some sort of prior qualification, as I said. In Europe, for example, not so much now, but many years ago, you couldn't get into a psychotherapy training until you were advanced in your ages, Mm-hmm. So it was more around looking at experienced practitioners going into a psychotherapy training. If we're looking at the traditional, which is what I'm trying to make a line in the sand mm-hmm. around.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, and I think you illustrate this in some of your stories in the book. I'm wondering what it was like for you to actually treat patients when you had undergone or were undergoing training in CBT, but before having ever taken any training in psychotherapy. And then I'm also wondering what it was like once you then entered training into psychotherapy. How was that different? How did that change the way that you worked with patients?
Firstly, it was a relief because in the CBT work that I did, I was often very frustrated. It was exhausting work. I think working with strategy is quite exhausting. The client's always looking for you to find a resolution for them. Yes, you are helping them find a way, but it's very much around trying to put things in place for them to lead their life in a better way. So in the early stages of my work, I was quite frustrated. Fortunately, I was optimistic and excited, so I hadn't got to a place of burnout, but that did happen. I was also fortunate in that my CBT training was very closely linked with my psychotherapy training, so I bumped into psychotherapy literally very close to the finish of my CBT training. And so as I slowly moved into that new paradigm, looking more deeply at the client, allowing them, a lot more time to be processing emotion, not trying to find a strategy for them, trying to unfold some material around why they were where they were, was almost a relief. I could feel the ease of how much more powerful for me that work was.
So CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, is really about working, usually in a time-limited frame, on specific and clearly defined goals, and using empowering the client with certain strategies to achieve those goals. But as I understand it, in CBT, the goals are usually pretty behaviorally defined. From your description, psychotherapy is a totally different process, and the work you do is much more long-term, much more in-depth. And so I'm wondering, at what point did you decide that this distinction was important enough to write a book about?
Yes, that distinction actually was driven by the public. I felt that I was very clear in my own mind around the difference between the two approaches. Every time I had a conversation with people, it didn't matter whether it was at a dinner party, at a bus stop, wherever it was, and the conversation arrived at, what do you do for work? And I would say psychotherapy. People would say, what's the difference between psychotherapy and psychiatry? What's the difference between psychotherapy and psychology or counseling or coaching? And this didn't happen once or twice. It happened repeatedly. And I started to wonder why those lines in the sand were not clear. And I think that was the beginning of me understanding that we as a profession perhaps don't clarify those lines. And those questions still happen now. Even while I was writing the book, there were occasions where I thought, is this too difficult? Is this too complex? How do I pull this apart? I was still being asked that same question, and I thought, somewhere I have to find the words to explain this difference for people. Because even the difference between psychiatry and psychology, even the difference between psychology and counseling, people don't understand that. So I did try to pick up a fairly large lump of the profession and tease it out to some degree.
And why do you think it's important for people to understand those distinctions?
Yes, that's a very, very important question. I find that people don't come into psychotherapy because they want to. I find that people come in because they've tried CBT, they've tried medication, they've been reading a lot of self-help, and for a lot of people that works really well and they get a result. Fantastic. But for other people where there's more long-standing, I'm going to say archaic damage, they haven't got a result. And a couple of things happen. One is that they feel like they are really unwell. They feel like a failure. They feel like they are the problem because they've not recovered from the esteemed approaches that are used through the CBT style of working. And so they come feeling more ill than ever. And it becomes important for us, I feel, to consider that the client is not always going to respond to short-term work. And I think in Australia, and I know in America as well, particularly because of the way the insurance works in America, the drive is to get the client to recover in the shortest possible way, in the shortest possible term that they can. And a lot of what we're dealing with now and seeing, we're not able to do that. That's like asking for a magic pill, really. And so we need to bring on board a consideration for clients that there is this longer-term approach that they might need if CBT or medication doesn't work, so the clients themselves don't feel mad, bad, and crazy.
So I wonder if then by implication you think that our clients would feel better and maybe have more success if they knew from the outset what the different approaches are, what each of them differs, what each of them offers that's different from the other one, and if that would help them to have more accurate expectations when they enter into some kind of psychotherapy or some other approach.
Yes, that's exactly what the purpose of the book is. The book is written for the general public. Obviously, the book isn't written from, you would know, for academia. It's written for the general public in an attempt to get them to be able to have that opportunity to say, oh, okay, so if I do medication, I can do medication, but I can try something else. I can try CBT. Well, if I don't try CBT, then there is actually something else. Yes, it is absolutely about the public being informed. And I think that it becomes incumbent on the profession to try to draw more clearly the lines in the sand. I had a client come who thought her psychiatrist was a counsellor. Now, while there's some work in that area, that's certainly not her psychiatrist's approach, basic approach. And so when I eventually spoke to him, he said, I don't know where that idea has come from, that she thinks that I'm a counsellor. So there it is in a nice tight little nutshell, that confusion.
Yeah, I mean, people can get lost in the mental health system, and what you're describing sounds like an example of someone being in one form of treatment while perhaps thinking that she's in a different form of treatment, or thinking it's supposed to be doing something different from what it really purports to do. I want you to tell us about the book, because you say it's written for the lay public, but it also has a particular style, I suppose you'd say. It's really a collection of stories. Tell us how that works and why you chose to make it a collection of anecdotes from your own work.
Yes, that was a difficult decision, and I think maybe for 10 years I paced the floor wondering what the right approach was, how to actually reach the public. I thought if I tried to write about what long-term work is, what short-term work is, I thought that the book would be quite dry. I started writing client stories as a bit of an experiment, and then I noticed that one story flowed into another story and flowed into another story, and I shared some of them with people and with colleagues, and eventually over workshopping this with people, I decided that the best thing to do for the public was to give very specific stories so they could see the difference. So you might notice in the beginning of the book I talk quite a bit about some of the CBT work that I did, and mm-hmm. I kind of dabble in my frustration around, you know, not being able to work something out, and then I move more into the longer term work where I'm working and explaining in the book the countertransference, the archaic work that the clients are doing. So the book evolved slowly over a period of time, thinking mostly about how was I going to get the clients or the public to read the book and understand the difference between the two. And it's a really interesting, you haven't mentioned this yet, but I will throw it in. There is a dog in the book. Mm. And so I, rightly or wrongly, which is very controversial in the field that I work in psychotherapy, brought a dog in. And one of the really good things about the dog is it liberated the stories. It gave me an opportunity to write easily relatable stories, so relatable stories to the public. So I noticed the stories that have the dog in it, people tend to relate to more easily. I'm not going to say everyone does, because not everyone likes dogs and animals, but for a majority of people, that allowed a sort of liberation of the story because of sibling rivalry and the issues that came as a result of bringing the dog into the room.
For our listeners who haven't had a chance to pick up the book yet, you're talking about Sadie, your dog, right?
Yes, that's right, yes.
So tell us a little more about what you think Sadie's presence does, or how it influences the process.
Well, it's interesting in that Sadie, for some clients who were unable to articulate or express When Sadie came into the room, they were able to use the dog as an opportunity to say things that perhaps they would not have been able to say before. Or she actually provoked material that people had not been able to express before, particularly things around, as I said, sibling rivalry and grief. Grief was a really big thing that Sadie was able to provoke for people. So it actually brought some of the work into the room. Now, I say in the book often, and I still ask this question, would that material have still found its way into the room with or without Sadie? I'm sure in the longer term it would have. But what it gave me in terms of writing the book is an opportunity to write it in a more pedestrian, user-friendly manner.
Why do you think it is that Sadie brings out issues related to sibling rivalry?
Well, because she appears to the client to be my child, and of course for some client adaptations, I'll use borderline in particular, then the client sees the dog as my child and there's immediately some rivalry or, let's say, jealousy there around the dog being in my life in a particular way and then not. And so that brings a lot of very, very rich, difficult material into the room.
You mentioned that you focus, among other things, on bringing up and discussing archaic material. What do you mean by that?
Yes, good question. Archaic material for me would mean material that belongs to early childhood. And it's usually very difficult material to find. Some of it is, I explain in the book, pre-verbal, so very difficult to find words. It happens before the child has language. And often a client will say, look, I don't know, it just feels like this. It just feels. And so we'll work with that around the feeling because, in fact, there could possibly be no words for that. And so archaic means something randomly pre-seven years old. So very, very early. It can be later than that, but very, very early material where the child is actually making a decision about the world based on what's happening in their home.
And when you say that you access this material, how exactly does that work? I mean, how do you bring forth something that occurred during a time when the patient probably didn't even have the language to encode it?
That's a very good question. That material finds its way into the room slowly. It depends at what stage the client is with their distress, where they arrive, and we start to look at patterns. I think patterns are the most important thing. So when people repeat doing things, we look at how that might have been in the family when they were younger or how a family member might have been, how a parent's behaviour might have been toward them, how they felt about their parents, any particular things that they did remember. That's usually the starting place.
So I'm going to play devil's advocate for a second because I know that many of our listeners will be hearing your description of this kind of work and thinking to themselves, you know, that sounds really great, but it sounds like it takes a lot of time and it would take a lot of money. And with there being so many other options out there for approaches that could help a person return to normal functioning or develop strategies for coping with their symptoms. And I'm not just talking about CBT. We have things like mindfulness and DBT and somatic experiencing. One might wonder, well, why should I spend this money and time to undergo this much longer process that's in order to uncover this archaic material when I can do just as well with shorter term work? What is unique? What does this longer term work offer, you think, that nothing else can?
Well, I think that the point in there is that it isn't that something else can offer it. I think that that's the key in this. I find that people come into psychotherapy after they have done many of the things that you have mentioned and I've mentioned, and they haven't got a result. Psychotherapy is like the product that people buy when someone has said, I've tried everything else and nothing else works. So it isn't something, it isn't a joyride. People don't come in going, yoo-hoo, I want to do some psychotherapy. I want to go into long-term work and rip my history apart and, you know, go back and drag up all the ugly things from my childhood. That is what happens. It usually is people that are, that have become desperate, that have not found a resolution, that have found a lot of things along their path very useful, but not actually fixed the symptoms of the problem. So I don't, I think that most people, and I mentioned this in the book, I see a lot of people that have seen many, many, many different practitioners, done many, many different approaches to try to get some sort of resolution, and they haven't. And the only reason they come to psychotherapy is because somebody has said, look, I know somebody that did this and it helped. That's usually the byline, I'm afraid. It's not a by choice.
You know, I'd like to talk about a particular story because I think it illustrates what we're talking about so well. There's a story entitled, What is Phobia? And in it, you talk about working with a female patient who had seen a psychiatrist and a psychologist before eventually coming to you. And those treatments had not cured her of her phobia. It was a phobia of leaving the house, I believe. Can you tell us a little bit about this case and what you learned from it?
It was a very, very important case. I think one of the things that she presented with was a sense of utter, absolute inadequacy. And as I pulled that apart, I began to realize, I think it was the first time I really began to realize that when people are treated with a form of, counseling, CBT, strategy, whatever, if it's not working, the client feels like they're the problem. Because what this client presented with is, they tried this, they took me on a bus, they tried to get me to cross. You know, she literally pushed me through the door and you know, went with me on the bus, and I was terrified. They did everything, and so she felt like everything had been done to help her rid herself of her agoraphobia, and that she was actually a problem. I think that was where the awareness for me around, there's something bigger going on. This is not actually about her inability to go outside. There is something much, much greater. And, of course, if we read a lot of the material from the more analytical field around agoraphobia in particular, it speaks to lack of attachment. And so once I started to work with her around the lack of attachment, we began to see a pattern in her family around her unavailable parents and, of course, you know, the terrified child and the fear of literally everything. So the approach around CBT was never going to work for her. It was actually making her symptoms far worse. By the time she came to me, she couldn't really leave the house. We did a lot of sessions by phone. Her partner had to bring her in the car and sit out the front so that if she needed to leave, she needed to leave. It was a very complex and difficult case.
But can you walk us through a little bit how it is, in terms of the way you conceptualize this case, how it is that something like attachment ends up leading to symptoms like agoraphobia, an inability to leave the house?
Well, to keep it as simple as possible, I believe that it happens as a result of the fear that the child develops very early on. So there is lack of attachment, so there's lack of safety, so there's lack of trust, so there's lack of support. So if you imagine that they become the foundations of that child's life, so the child hasn't grown up with warmth and love and safety and trust. So there's this already very corrupt foundation that they put their lives on. So as their lives move forward and bad things happen, that they don't have a place to defer to that is safe and solid. They only have a place of fear. And so the fear becomes greater and greater and greater, that there won't be anybody there for them, that there isn't anybody there for them, that the world is very scary. It's a little bit, I use the analogy in the book, it's a little bit like building a house on a muddy foundation. The house is eventually going to start to crack and crumble. Well, it's a very similar outcome for people that do not have that solid attachment when they're born, and there's not that real bond. And one of the things that we have come to learn about her mother is that her mother and father did not want to be married. They were very unhappy, and this child was a product that kept them together. And so she was, for her most of her life, she was rejected and ejected from their lives. So she never ever had a sense of security. She never had a sense of love. And so that made her house very, very shaky. So anytime anything threatening came into her world, as I said, she had nothing solid to put her life on.
So this makes me wonder something that I think a lot of therapists might struggle with. And it is, you know, it seems to me like doing this kind of work requires a certain kind of curiosity, not just in yourself, but really in the patient. And I'm wondering, when you have a patient come into your office who sort of insists or really wants a faster solution, who desperately wants to be able to start leaving the house right away and doesn't understand or doesn't really have an interest in this longer term work, how do you cultivate that kind of curiosity in such a patient?
Look, by the time, as I'm going to go back to what I said before around, I don't usually have to do a lot around that because they've already done that themselves. I don't have to force that approach for the person. One of the things I always do when somebody comes is I'm very clear about what psychotherapy is. I talk about, you know, that it's a long approach, that it's an emotional roller coaster, that it is expensive because it takes so long. And I think that if someone can get that outside, I will refer them on. And often when I see people, that I will refer them on. I'll say, okay, so it doesn't sound like this is a journey for you. And then we will find them somebody else to work with. The people that I work with are usually people that themselves say, I haven't been able to find a resolution. And so they're already in for the long haul.
But I assume you must have moments, even with the patients who are signed up for the long journey, moments of impatience, either moments when they become impatient, maybe you become impatient. You don't know what's going on. It's not unfolding as you would hope that it would. And how do you deal with those moments?
Look, I think if I had those moments frequently, it would mean I'm not trained as a psychotherapist. I think you're touching on a really important point here, because a part of the process is to know that the path is not clear. The theory is very clear. The way you work with the client is very clear, and it is actually about being patient. So I think if I get impatient, it means that there's something going on for me, which obviously I take off to supervision. The client frequently gets to that place. They're very frustrated. They're very and it's a conversation around, you know, how they move forward, what they want. Have they had any change at this point? But people will only stay in a process like this if they're getting something out of it. They're not going to stay if they're not getting something out of it. So by the time frustrations start to come up around, I feel like I'm stuck, I feel like I'm at an impasse, I feel like I'm not getting anywhere, this is taking too long, we already have a fairly good basis for them to know that they've understood a lot of things, that they have had some change, though it might not be the amount of change that they want, that we're working toward. There is enough for them to step on and say, well, actually, yes, I have got what I want. I do want to do this. It's just very frustrating. And then we work with that.
I want to talk to you about the difference, as you see it, between psychotherapy in the United States and in Australia. And we've touched a little bit on how insurance companies sort of dominate or have a heavy hand on the scale here in the United States. I'm wondering if you find the same thing in Australia. I'm wondering in Australia, number one, you know, how friendly is the healthcare environment towards something like psychotherapy? And I'm also wondering if the average person in Australia understands psychotherapy to be a long-term process, because that's not what you find here in the United States.
I'm going to answer your last question first and work my way back. No, in Australia, I say we're about 20 years behind Europe. We do not have a high level of understanding about psychotherapy. We are starting to develop an awareness. That's one of the reasons I wrote the book, in an attempt to clarify and bring out what psychotherapy is. We have a slightly different system here. Our insurance companies do not cover, well, they might cover, you know, 3 to 5 sessions of counselling for a client if they are covered. It will not cover longer term like your insurance companies tend to do. We have a slightly different system in that many, many years ago, 2006, I write about this in the book, our government really began to realise we have a mental health problem. And, you know, to their credit, they developed a program where they said, okay, so people are going to get 5 to 10 and potentially 8 sessions where they can go to a psychologist and get treatment for this. That worked relatively well in the early stages. People were pouring into the CBT counselling approach. Now, one of the things that we're finding 10 years on is that they were given maybe, as I said, 18 sessions. Most people are only using 5. So the government recently restructured that program to give people a minimum of 10. They're finding that people are not getting the resolution that they wanted through the CBT work. One of the things I'm hoping to do is to talk more about what it will mean to implement longer-term work. Obviously, the government isn't going to fund that because our program here through the government, the Better Access Program, has become unwieldy in terms of finance. The government's really struggling to support it, and that's why they wound it back some time ago. So they realise that there's a huge problem. They put something in place that hasn't necessarily worked. The people that they wanted to access that also are not accessing it. And so now they're back to the drawing board.
So speaking of governments, do you think that this way in which psychotherapy is misunderstood, do you think that it's a public health issue and that states and governments should pay more attention to it and do something more about it?
Yes, I do. Yes, and I mentioned that in the book. One of the things that I'm in the process of doing is speaking to the corrective services, because I mentioned this in the book, that if we have people in our corrective services for 10 years, they're a captive audience. Why are we not doing longer-term work with them? Why are we not doing more work around why they found themselves there? So there is a lot of work to do in this area. I think if we can pull psychotherapy out of being an intervention, which is what you see in the States and not so much here and certainly but not in Europe, if we can pull it out as a standalone for how it was really developed, we are going to have another option. And I think the difficulty is getting it recognised as a standalone style of working with clients in a longer term approach.
I wonder sometimes if part of the reason why psychotherapy is misunderstood is because over time it's been increasingly tied to the medical model. And if you think that we might be better understood if we sort of separated ourselves a bit from medicine, and if perhaps we would be seen more like shaman or as spiritual healers.
I'm very reluctant to go that road, because therein lays the initial problem of, yes, they're kooks and quacks. So we need to be very careful about going that road. We're not a sophisticated society around looking at anything deeper than science has to give us. But I think one of the things that is happening is that there is the move away from the medical model by the public. And I think one of the reasons that I was encouraged to write the book is I did a lot of work from the professional level and tried to work at the political level around getting change. And so after maybe a decade plus of that, I decided that it needed to come from the public. The questions were coming from the public. So I felt like then the questions needed to come from the public. So what I feel we need to do is create a groundswell where the public start to say, well, why isn't this psychotherapy in this as an option for me? Why isn't it part of the medical model? Why are we not looking at psychotherapy as an option? So I think that's going to need to come from the public rather than from a spiritual an area that's not really highly regarded, like shamanism.
You know, speaking of the medical model, I'm wondering what you think about the use of diagnoses, particularly the diagnostic statistical manual or the ICD. Sometimes clients come in and they think of themselves in terms of a diagnosis. Oh, I'm bipolar or I have depression. And I'm wondering if you think that kind of language is helpful or harmful in helping people.
I don't know what it is, but people love a tag. It's almost like there's relief once they have a little tag. I think diagnosis is brilliant. I think we need it, and I don't think we should move away from it. I think one of the problems with diagnosis is that it has become a mire. It's dragged the professions down. We have created these extensive diagnoses around what a client is, what a client does, how a client thinks, and I think we've lost sight of the client. The client becomes a series of descriptions that's in, you know, the DSM-5. I think that it's helpful in terms of us knowing what the approach is, and I mentioned this in the book as well. So, you know, I want to know that what the difference is between a schizoid adaptation and a borderline adaptation, because I'm going to approach that quite differently. So we do need to know. We need to know that somebody has schizophrenia and that, you know, psychosis is a problem. So we need to have a diagnostic tool of some description. The problem with our diagnostic tool is that it swamps the client. The client is no longer a person. They are a series of diagnoses, and I think that in itself is a huge problem.
You know, I had a supervisor one time describe his recommended use of diagnoses in terms of writing things in light pencil. In other words, using them as a kind of general frame of reference for understanding a group of symptoms and behaviors, but without really putting it in permanent marker, meaning without really treating it as a concrete, tangible thing, because they're constructs and not everybody is going to fit the same categories in the same ways. Do you find the same thing?
Yes, I do. Your supervisor was far more appropriate than mine. Mine told me when I studied the DSM, I needed to sit on the toilet and not take it seriously. So I agree with that. I think it is important background noise, but it certainly has got to stop being the way we see people. Yes.
You know, the story we discussed earlier about the patient with agoraphobia kind of illustrated how a set of symptoms or a condition or a presenting problem can really be misunderstood. And I'm wondering, of all the people in your book, or even of all the folks you've worked with, do you think that there's a particular disorder or human condition that is most misunderstood by society right now?
Oh, that's a really big question. I think this is really simplified, but I think that depression is misunderstood. Depression and I want to say grief. I mentioned grief a lot in the book. I think they're two areas where we've started to use them as interchangeable so much that we no longer understand what it really means. And to have depression is very debilitating. To be grieving something, whether it is a recent death or whether it is the loss of a childhood, is a very, very, very painful painful experience. And I think the thing has become a joke. If we look at social media now, I mean, sometimes I look at some of the things on social media that people are laughing at or making fun of, and I think, my goodness, what must it be like for that person to live like that? So I think that we're not understanding the depth of what that person suffers. And I think that this is being played out in, I write about self-killing, suicide as most people know it. We have unprecedented levels of suicide. And I feel like there's no place for people to go now. And so the backstop is suicide. So I think there is something very serious happening around how we look at what people are struggling with these days.
What would you say depression is?
Depression is, for me, the person's way of suppressing and repressing everything which has ever hurt them, has ever been painful, or has ever been difficult. It's that simple. And in many ways, it's actually just squashing down every single thing that that person has ever lived that has been difficult for them. And I think that that's why a lot of the CBT doesn't work, is that we can't get to that material in a handful of sessions. That's longer-term work where we peel back a layer after layer after layer after layer ad nauseum to find what the client has really suffered, where the client really is, why the client really has depression. Depression cannot be cured through a set of strategies. And that takes me to medication. Look, medication's great for a lot of people, but I see a lot of people that have been on and off several medications and not had a resolution. And, of course, as I say in the book, if you can take a pill, we are a society of instant gratification. If we can take a pill and things are better, then great, fantastic, we're going to do that. People don't embark on psychotherapy if there's something simpler to do.
Mm-hmm. You know, this discussion about depression and about the way we misunderstand conditions makes me think about the future, and it makes me want to ask you if you could hypothetically make a suggestion or set of suggestions to training programs who are training our future psychologists and psychotherapists, or if you could give some advice to future psychotherapists themselves, what would it be?
Look, it would be to get out there and talk about it. I think one of the things that we do as a profession is we write acres and acres of material advancing how we can help the client get better, basically. Paper after paper after paper is produced in an attempt to get a better result for the client, which is great. But I think the thing that's more important is the clients actually know the difference and they know what they can get and how that will work. I think the more we do that, the more we're going to draw the clients into the longer term work, the clients that need it, draw them into the work and get them some sort of resolution. I think we also need to find a way into the schools. I read an interesting comment on one of my social media things last night. It was a blog where a guy writes in his journal every day and he says, oh, and I don't write much about emotions because, you know, we don't really want to pay much attention to those. And this is a very prominent international speaker. And I thought, it's the reverse that we need. We need to go into the schools, into the primary schools, and a part of the curriculum is that the kids all sit around and talk about what's going on for them. I think that that's where we need to start.
So it sounds like you believe we need to teach people early to be what I think some would call emotionally intelligent.
That's exactly what I'm saying, yes.
So what suggestions do you have for someone who's listening to this interview and maybe has been toying with the idea for a long time of going into psychotherapy but has always been kind of nervous about it or unsure about whether to do it and maybe even unsure about how to find good treatment, find the right treatment? What first step should that person take to find good treatment?
Well, perhaps what they could do is go to my website and read how to find a psychotherapist. And by that, I mean what they want to start doing is asking the appropriate questions. Because if somebody advertises as a psychotherapist, they are potentially a psychotherapist, but that person, the client still doesn't know if they're going to get that sort of treatment. They could also be walking into something that is more CBT. So what they need to know is that the professional is trained in psychotherapy specific, that they have done their own work. I think that is probably, for me, the single most important component is that the psychotherapist has taken all their own skeletons out of the closet and spread them all over the place and looked at them. Mm. And that they are in some sort of supervision of their work so that they can deal with the difficulties that arise around the transference and the counter-transference, because that can be exhausting. So the client now becomes educated around what a psychotherapist is and can interview. So the other thing I would encourage people to do is talk to 2, 3, 4, 5 professionals and find out how they work. I think one of the things that we do is we trust, the clients trust us. So a client of mine read my book recently and she came in and she said, "I've never seen your qualifications." I said, "No, you haven't. I don't put them all over the wall." So I rummaged through the office drawer and there they were. So people are very trusting. They come trusting that what we say we are, we are. And I think we need to encourage the public to ask more questions.
And since you've done the work of compiling a list of questions for people, can you tell us what your website is?
Yes, it's my name. It's www.joefrasca.com.
Well, I think everybody should check that out. And Joe, this really has been a very enlightening and I think a very timely conversation. Before we go, can you tell us what you're working on now?
Well, interestingly, I sent my book out to many publishers. One publisher, one very prominent academic publisher, came back to me and said, "We don't publish for the general public, but we love your book. However, what we would like you to do is write about the effect of an animal in the room for academia." So I'm in the process of collaborating with people around the world to write a book that is very slow at the moment because I've been concentrating on this book. It's kind of taken off and I need to give it the energy that it requires. But that's my next project, and I'm also blogging more as well in the hope of that blog bumping into a person who's in the middle of the night feeling depressed and trolling the internet and going, "Oh, right, so this is what psychotherapy is." So they're probably my two-pronged approach at the moment.
And your blog is also at joefrasca.com?
Yes, yes it is.
Well, those sound like exciting projects. Will you let us know when the next book comes out?
Absolutely, I will. Thank you.
That sounds exciting. Well, Joe, thank you so much for joining us today, and good luck on the book tour.
Thank you very much.
All right, take care. That was my interview with Joe Frasca, author of the book Delving Deeper, Understanding Diverse Approaches While Exploring Psychotherapy. This is Eugenio Duarte for New Books in Psychology in New York. I really welcome your feedback, so please go to my website, www.eugenioduartephd.com, and click on blog and podcast to find this episode and leave me a comment. Have a great week.